Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Something not good is happening in the American Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives. Last week, Congress failed to agree on a resolution against anti-Semitism. Turns out that there are a number of new members of Congress who are unabashedly anti-Semitic. That would not be the entire problem, because there are always anti-Semites lurking everywhere, even in the U.S. Congress. The problem is that these anti-Semites are new members of Congress, and the leadership of the Democratic Party wants to kowtow to these members and butter them up. Leadership wants to appeal to young people, which is their right. Several of these outspoken new members of Congress have been assigned to prestigious and important committees, like the Committee on Foreign Affairs. This is a blatant act of buttering up, since these people have no background in foreign relations. They were elected primarily on local issues and on their youth and personalities. But the party leadership is willing to put up with them and to put them in positions of responsibility at the expense of both the United States and especially at the expense of the Jews. This is an ominous factor, both for the Jews in the United States as well as the relationship between the United States and Israel. I'll say a few words about this topic, which will certainly grow in importance in the future and perhaps very soon. I'll also say a few words about the upcoming election in Israel. There are about 30 parties running for places in the Knesset, so no matter how many get representation, it's going to be very splintered, with at least 10 factions gaining representation. This means that whoever puts together a government, which means essentially making a block of at least 61 seats, whoever does that is going to have to compromise in a way that will make its campaign promises into a bad joke. This reminds me of the famous American humorist Will Rogers said about the United States Congress. He said, every time they make a joke, it becomes a law, and every law they make becomes a joke. But I'm afraid that's the price of democracy, so I have to make this the best we can with it. I'll be back after the break. Thanks again for listening.
I'm Jono Vandoor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind,
every Thursday.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. We are now being witness to something that I did not think that I would see, at least not in my lifetime. Back in the 1930s, there was a lot of public anti-Semitism, and the Nazi movement was in the United States, but that ended with the Second World War, and anti-Semitism went out of style in the public arena, at least when I was a kid after the Second World War, because of the Holocaust. Although I remember a time when I was younger that my father, who owned a drugstore, wanted to move to various different neighborhoods to move out of the center of the city in Philadelphia, and he couldn't rent a store or buy a store because of anti-Semitism. But I thought that had all disappeared, particularly now that there are laws in the United States to prevent that kind of thing. But unfortunately, it's now back at the highest levels of the U.S. government, unfortunately, and unfortunately both for the Jews, for Israel, and for the United States. The United States Congress failed a couple of weeks ago to agree on anti-Semitic resolution in a debate that now has become fraught with controversy and has Israel at the center of this controversy. The argument focuses on whether condemnation of anti-Semitism should be a broader condemnation of racism in general. This is particularly true because the anti-Semitism is being made public by several members of Congress who happen to belong to a different minority, to the Islam minority. So this is the first time in recent memory that Congress has been so publicly divided on issues relating both to American Jews, anti-Semitism, and also to Israel. The inability to agree on a resolution on anti-Semitism is symbolic of a larger debate taking place in the United States in which politics and communities are increasingly divided on both Jewish and Israel-related issues. Now, there's no doubt that U.S.-Israel relations are important and must not be eroded due to partisan politics. Every time that a discussion about Israel starts to become an issue with members of one party against another party, it inevitably pushes away allies across the aisle. This could be seen in Congress. That's happening today. What began as a consensus quickly eroded. There are several new congressmen in the United States, two of whom are a lady congressman, congresswomen, one of whom is Ilhan Omar, and she's been very critical of Israel. She's also one of several younger and progressive members of Congress. The other two are Rashida Tlaib, who is also a Muslim, and Alexandria Cortasio-Cortez. By the way, they took office in January. We're only 2 months into their office, but they've gotten so much media coverage. This one of them, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is already referred to by her initials, AOC, just like FDR and Harry Truman had a name. Anyhow, these congressmen have entered the House of Representatives and intend to agree on a variety of issues. They are very critical of Israel, and AOC tends to be less critical of Israel. But she's a progressive, has made efforts to reach out to progressive Jewish voices. Now, the questions surrounding these freshmen is whether their stances and recent comments are anti-Semitic or merely harsh criticism of Israel. Those who want to protect these people say that they're simply being critical of Israel. They're not being anti-Semites. But the choice of words that they use are from the anti-Semitic treasury of words. For example, they tweet, one of them, Omar, tweeted 2 months ago, a tweet that connects his support for AIPAC, which is a lobby for Israel. The tweet essentially gave connection between AIPAC and to financial influence. And this was seen by many, and I think rightfully so, as being anti-Semitic. Later, this congresswoman said that there is a political influence in the United States that says it's okay to push for allegiance to a foreign country, referring to Israel. In other words, if you're favorable to Israel, they're questioning your allegiance to the United States. The question of allegiance to Israel appeared to speak to dual loyalty, which is a terrible, terrible thing to say about the Jews. And of course, Omar sought to shield herself from pushback by arguing that because they are Muslims, They are unfairly targeted with the false allegations of anti-Semitism, which is interesting because the Muslims are certainly a minority in the United States. So when they say anti-Semitic things, they protect themselves by claiming they are also a minority. That is why this anti-Semitic bill or this resolution is broadened to include the Muslims. A lot of the colleagues in Congress, particularly the Jews, not only the Jews, were outraged about a foreign allegiance statement. No member of Congress is asked to swear allegiance to another country. Throughout history, Jews have been accused of dual loyalty, leading to discrimination and violence, which is why these accusations are hurtful. What I just said now, I'm quoting from a Jewish congresswoman named Nita Lowey, L-O-W-E-Y. Another Jewish member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel, another Jew, criticized these comments and said it's unacceptable and deeply offensive to call into question the loyalty of fellow American citizens. By the way, this Omar became a member. She's brand new in Congress. She became a very important Foreign Affairs Committee because the Democratic leadership is trying to butter up to these new people, especially trying to appeal to young people. By the way, when I was a kid, everybody I knew was a Democrat. Everybody was under the impression somehow that Franklin Roosevelt had saved the world, which in a sense he did, but he didn't care much about the Jews. But the Jews thought that his actions were very pro-Jewish, just fighting the war. Unfortunately, there are also left-leaning Jewish activists and organizations like J Street who are defending these people. Several senators, including Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, both of whom are trying to run for president, they disagree with efforts to condemn Omar, while Speaker Nancy Pelosi did not provide a clear stance. Omar was painted as a victim by many progressive who have pushed for a wider combination of all forms of hate. In other words, anti-Semitic is something that stands by itself. It was the resolution was watered down to include all kinds of hate, including hate of Muslims. So the Muslims could be anti-Semitic, but they turned themselves into victims. So now critics of Israel are quite happy. Not only was the remarks by this young lady, this Muslim, not only were her remarks vindicated, but it appears that accusing supporters of Israel of having foreign allegiance or foreign loyalty is considered more acceptable today in Washington. It's a very disturbing development because not only is this happening in Washington, but it's happened in another major Western country, Great Britain. The UK's Labour Party is openly anti-Semitic now. Toxic anti-Semitism has become all too normal today. The idea, the notion that anti-Semitism must always be lumped in with other forms of racism is simply wrong. The anti-Semitism stands by itself. Anti-Semitism is not only unique, but is worthy of having clear red lines in order to highlight the code words that underpin it. This is especially true in light of the unprecedented rise in hate crimes in the United States, in particular against Jews. So we would like to think that these critics of Israel should learn to differentiate between genuine criticism about Israel's policies, which is certainly acceptable, but opposed to this, there is veiled and blatant anti-Semitism, which the words of these new congressmen are scathing. We haven't had this, at least not in my lifetime, especially not since the Second World War. So the state of Israel and the Jewish people are approaching a crisis and the relationship to the United States Congress, at least, because now we have people who are anti-Semitic, but they paint themselves as victims because they claim that they themselves are a minority. And I'm speaking, of course, about the Muslims. So we have an interesting development here. You have a minority which claims to be a victim in order to defend its own anti-Semitic policies. This is pretty new at the high levels of Congress and something we have to keep an eye on. I'll be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about the upcoming election in Israel in April. I don't want to go into too much detail because it's quite confusing. There is something like 30 parties running for the Knesset, for the Israeli parliament, and in order to get any of members elected, they have to get a little over 3% of the vote. So obviously most of these parties are not going to make it. The result is that the number of parties contending and the map of those parties is very fragmented. So the next Knesset is all expected to be very splintered because at least 10 factions will gain representation. The same holds true to the government, which in any conceivable political constellation will likely contain at least 5 factions. While the largest ruling faction in the next Knesset is likely to gain between 30 and 37 seats, about a quarter to almost a third of the total Knesset membership, or slightly more, is its far smaller percentage than in the past. In other words, in order to form a government, you have to have an 120-seat Knesset. You have to be able to put together a coalition of at least 61. Which, of course, is not stable, but it's a majority. And if you have to make these 61 out of a possible 5 parties, because the largest parties only get 30 or 37 seats, so it's always a mess. This situation has very far-reaching consequences for the work of the Knesset and the government. In order to put together a coalition, the largest faction will need to conduct negotiations with many other factions and essentially have to pay a price to each faction in order to get them to join the coalition. Then, once a coalition is formed, the Prime Minister will need to cope with pressures that are exerted on him by the many factions in the government, making it difficult to advance and implement a solid, coherent policy. That's been a problem since the State of Israel came into being. Now, while the fragmented nature of party politics in Israel is to some extent a result of Israel's diverse population, it's also closely related to the electoral system and to the mechanism for forming a new government, which does not give the larger factions a big enough advantage. So that in order to form a government, a faction needs to put together a coalition that can win a confidence motion in the Knesset, which means at least 61 seats. In other words, The size of a given faction is not the deciding factor as to whether it will become the ruling party. Rather, what counts is the ability to put together a sufficiently broad coalition, meaning at least 61 votes. While in most cases the task of forming a new government is conferred on the head of the largest faction, that does not always hold true. For example, I remember back in 2009, just 10 years ago, when the head of the Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu, was charged by the president with forming a government, even though the largest faction was called Kadima, which is headed by Tzipi Livni, both of which are no longer around. See, theoretically, the task of putting together a government is given to that party which can most probably form a stable coalition. So, in order to cut down the extent of this political splintering, the process of forming a government really should be reformed. That perhaps I'll talk about at a different time. I want to talk a little bit about some of the people who are now running for office, because, you know, a group of generals has put together a political party. I think it's now called Blue and White, which are the colors of the Israeli flag. It started had a different name, but it coalesced with one or two other parties and formed a new one. Now, it's made up primarily, the top of this party is made up of former generals, actually heads of the Israeli army. Now, heads of the army, if you look in the United States, very few generals have been presidents, and some have been successful and some not. For example, Ulysses Grant was a general. He was not a successful president. Eisenhower was a general. I guess you could say he was pretty successful. Of course, George Washington was a general. He's the father of the country. Adlai Stevenson, a very capable man, ran against Eisenhower both in 1952 and 1956, and he lost both times. And his comment afterwards was, and the only advice I can give anybody is never run against a war hero. Now, being a war hero does not necessarily mean you'll be a good general. It certainly makes your name very popular. And the question is, what kind of government will be established after the election on April 9th? Now, right now, the polls change every day. I think they're totally meaningless. The Blue and White Party, with all the generals, is leading Likud by 5 or 6 seats based on the recent polls. But even if it had more seats than the Likud, it may not be able to form a coalition. On the other hand, while Likud appears to get closer to the 61 seats needed, it itself does not have a majority. So it's hard to tell what they'll put together. I just want to say one word about the heads of this Blue and White Party, because it's interesting. One of them is Moshe Ya'alon, who is the head of the army during the Second Intifada and one of the commanders over Operation Defensive Shield, that saw Israel reconquer the West Bank following the Park Hotel and Seder massacre back in 2002. Another name at the top of the list is Gabi Ashkenazi, who was appointed chief of staff after the second Lebanon war against Hezbollah. He oversaw the rehabilitation of the military. He oversaw the bombing of Syria's nuclear reactor, as well as Operation Castlet, during which approximately 1,400 Palestinians were killed. As a matter of fact, an infamous report called the Goldstein Report accused the IDF of being overly aggressive and committing war crimes. So that's Ashkenazi, and that's Ya'alon. The third former head of the army is Benny Gantz. He replaced Ashkenazi as the head of the army He commanded over the IDF when it began its covert war against Iran's entrenchment in Syria, and he ended his term shortly after Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. It was a 50-day military campaign in which over 2,100 Palestinians were killed. And now, of course, these are more or less successful generals. There are a couple of generals who were successful as generals. He didn't make it as heads of the government. One is Yitzhak Rabin. He was a famous war hero and the IDF chief during the famous historic Six-Day War. But he signed the Oslo Accords and he shook the Yasser Arafat's hand, and he ended up legitimizing a murderous terrorist. Another general, a head of the army, was Ehud Barak, who another highly decorated chief of staff. He became the prime minister, went to Camp David, where he offered Arafat almost all the West Bank, half of Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. The Palestinian leader's answer was an unprecedented terrorism and onslaught against Israel. So Yaalon is the most hawkish of these of the three. Oh, by the way, another one was Ehud Barak. He was a highly decorated chief of staff. He became prime minister. He went to Camp David. And so he wasn't too successful as the head of the government. I looked at my notes here. Anyhow, the most hawkish of the three is Moshe Yaalon. And he's opposed to a Palestinian state. He supports continued Israeli building in Judea and Samaria and is against the withdrawal of even one single Israeli settlement. And while the other two generals, Ashkenazi and Gantz, have previously expressed support for two states, both have said that for several years now that they do not believe such a solution is possible for the foreseeable future. So, look, it's hard to know what they'll do, especially look at our own prime minister now, Netanyahu. Back in 2009, he was the first prime minister who froze settlement construction for 9 months and continued to refuse to permit construction even after the freeze was limited. By the way, he released over 1,500 Palestinian terrorists from Israeli prison. And as finance minister, he voted several times for disengagement from the Gaza Strip. And now, most recently, he's the prime minister who's transferring $15 million every month to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. So it's hard to know, really hard to know, whether generals will make good prime ministers. Experience in many countries, like the United States and Israel, which I'm familiar with, have shown this to be a mixed bag. Being a good general does not necessarily mean you'll be a good head of state. But and I don't think, by the way, here in Israel, the generals have as much aura about them as they used to. Too many Israelis have served in the army, and they've seen these people up close. Anyway, I just want to touch upon some thoughts about the upcoming election. I'll be back after the break.
Leap of Faith with Penina Taylor.
We live in the age of information, but not inspiration. If you're like me, you're looking to be inspired, to reach higher, to connect more, and to grow. Well, if you want to get warm, you need to stand close to the fire. And if you want to catch fire, you need to stand close enough to get hit by the sparks. Join me, Penina Taylor, as we walk with people who have embarked on a spiritual journey towards Torah. We'll uncover what started them on their journey and what truths they discovered along the way. So prepare to be inspired as we take a leap of faith every Sunday at 5 p.m. on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I've had occasion in the past to mention to the listeners that when I grew up in Philadelphia, everybody I knew, every Jew that I knew, voted for the Democratic Party. The big cities at that time were run by Democrats, and they saw to it that they did things for the people. They got the trash collected and all kind of little things like that. And most of the people were unsophisticated. They were not interested in global politics other than as it affected the Jews. And they relied on the local politicians to take care of their needs. And the local politicians were primarily Democrats. And then, and they also, people looked upon the Republicans as being the rich and cold class. That's how I remember it as a kid. I remember Jacob Javits was a senator from New York. He was a Jew and he was a Republican. I remember as a kid thinking, how can anybody vote for him? It was like against the religion. At any rate, everybody worshipped Roosevelt because they thought he had saved the world. After the war, it was found out how he had treated the Jews, which is a story unto itself. But today, to this very day, the overwhelming number of Jews vote for Democrats. That is somewhere between about 85% of the Jews who vote for the Democratic candidate. And now we've been having some trouble first with Obama, vis-a-vis the Jews, vis-a-vis Israel. What they like, the politicians, is the big Jewish contributors, because they need them. So they pay lip service to a lot of things that are good for the Jews. And now we have a problem that there are several members of the House of Representatives who are openly anti-Semitic. Several of them happen to be Muslims, but whether that's the reason or not is really immaterial. They are openly anti-Israel and openly anti-Semitic. So I want to say a few words about, and what I'd like to do is quote something which I read several days ago, written by someone who I consider an expert, and I think he's worth quoting. His name is Rabbi Balech. He's been a professor of Talmud at Yeshiva University since around 1966. He was the rabbi of Young Israel of Oceanside for 37 years. And he's written many books on Judaism and the Jewish people. And he speaks on Jewish topics to communities around the world. I heard him speak. He's an excellent speaker. Now, he wrote an article, which I want to quote, actually, because he says it so well. The article is called Jews and Political Suicide, and it goes like this. To tell the truth, I'm not surprised at the resurgence of anti-Semitism, not only across the world, but even here in the United States. Anti-Semitism is an ancient sickness, long ago predicted by the Torah and the prophets, historically rooted in theological hatred as well as xenophobic fears, and utilized by despots of every generation to scapegoat Jews as a way of diverting attention from their own crimes. What continues to amaze me, though, is, and let me be as blunt about this as possible, what continues to amaze me is Jewish stupidity. Jews are supposed to be smart. We never stop boasting, at least to ourselves, about the number of Nobel Prize winners from our people, the amazing contributions we have made and continue to make to the world in every field of endeavor. Why is it then, when it comes to politics, to make our voices heard in ways which promote the most important areas of our self-interest and even our survival, we seem to abdicate reason and side with those who make clear that they are our enemies? A number of years ago, in a now classic article in Commentary Magazine, Philip Himmelfarb made the astute observation that Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. Jews may have risen to financial security, but their political support remained solidly with liberal causes in line with the disenfranchised and economically oppressed in the social order. Jews voted more in line with their liberal views than their personal needs. Leonard Fine said explicitly, he said, politics is our religion, our preferred denomination is liberalism. And that may have been Fine a generation or two ago. Liberalism, which preaches fairness, liberalism, which is grounded in biblical and Jewish traditions of concern for fellow human beings, is a cause to which may all subscribe with devotion. But there is a tragic truth we have learned in the recent past. It has taken off on college campuses across the country as it has made its appearance in organizations ostensibly founded on liberal concern for justice and equal treatment for all, no matter race or religion. It has even, and most concerning, found an unlikely home in the Congress of the United States of America. It is nothing less than hateful liberalism. Liberalism with love for all, just not for the Jews. Liberalism with fairness for all, just not for Israel. In a collection of some of the best, funniest, and most profound lines in cinema history, critics cite the Oscar-winning Woody Allen movie scene in Anna Hall, where Alvy Singer, played by Allen, tells the woman who will become his first wife, "Right, I'm a bigot, I know, but for the left." It is a revolution, almost prophetic. Bigots exist not only as fanatics on the right, they can also very often come in the form of bigots on the left. Liberals who demand equality for the LGBT community and then side with the Palestinians against their Israeli oppressors seem to have no problem with the inherent contradiction that Palestinians throw gays off rooftops to their deaths while Israel permits gay parades as part of their being a democracy. Liberals manage to overlook the pay-to-slay policy of Palestinians, giving lifetime rewards to Arab terrorists who murder innocents, like 19-year-old Ori Ansbacher recently, a young Orthodox Jewish girl who was completing a year of compulsory national service in Israel, working with children at a youth center in Jerusalem. Somehow, there are a lot of bigots on the left, bigots whose hearts only bleed for the non-Jewish blood and couldn't care in the least when the victims are victims of anti-Semitism, which is the oldest hate in history. And now bigots have found a home in Congress. Bigots feel free to spew hate-filled memes in the words of the Ilhan Omar, calling on Americans to acknowledge that Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel, and that Israel is an apartheid state regime. BDS, the movement whose goal is to ultimately bring the very existence of Israel to an end, has a significant number of defenders in Congress, many of whom will be running for president in the next election. So I return to my contention that when it comes to politics, Jews somehow display an incredible level of stupidity. Politicians have come to take for granted that Jews are willing to forsake their self-interest. Jews earn like Puerto Ricans and vote like Puerto Ricans, or Puerto Ricans themselves are smart enough to vote for what's good for Puerto Ricans. Why is it then that only Jews think it is indecent for Jews to ask themselves at the voting booth the most obvious question, is it good for the Jews? In a country where barely 50% go to the polls, Jewish voter turnout averages around 85%. In a presidential system based on electoral votes, where key swing states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, Jews have sizable concentrations. In southern Florida, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Detroit, Jews are theoretically blessed with considerable political power. That potential influence, however, is wasted, and unlike any other voting bloc of comparable self-interest, it's negated by its unwillingness to identify and fight for its own causes. Ilhan Omar, this new representative, was elected after her pro-Palestinian views and anti-Semitic tropes were already well known. She cruised to victory in November in Minnesota's 5th District, which encompasses Minneapolis and some of its suburbs, including St. Louis Park has a large Jewish population. The seat opened up when 12-year incumbent Representative Keith Ellison, with past ties with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, decided to run for state attorney general, to which he was in fact elected. Jews are smart. But when it comes to politics, we have a long history of stupidity. We still can't believe we have enemies. We still can't acknowledge there are evil people who want to destroy us. We still can't recognize that those who express anti-Semitic ideas really mean what they say, even if they subsequently offer half-hearted apologies. In an age where the lessons of the Holocaust seem to have been condemned to forgetfulness, we can't afford to become victims of political suicide. It is high time for the Jews, as every other group anxious about its own survival, to make it, is it good for the Jews, a chief concern in our voting behavior. That is the end of this quote from Rabbi Benjamin Blech, who I said is a professor of Talmudish University, and he's an internationally recognized educator, religious leader, and lecturer. Generally, I don't make a full quote on this program, but this really sums it up. I think it's worthwhile for the listeners to hear what Rabbi Blech had to say. Could he put his finger right on it? The Jews go to the voting booths in the United States, and almost by reflex action, they pull a lever that says Democratic. And they ought to take a good look whose name appears on that lever, because if you look at what's happening, particularly in the House of Representatives today, you have these anti-Semites who are very public about it and who are being supported by the leadership of their party, the Democratic Party. We have a very serious problem facing us. I think the United States in general has a problem, but the Jewish problem is a subset of that problem, and it's extremely unpleasant. Having said that, I'm not sure I'll have a program next week, but next week will be Purim. So, again, I'm not sure I'm going to have a program, so let me wish everybody a happy Purim. Here in Jerusalem, we celebrate a day later, so I'm really not sure if I'm going to have a program. Having said all that, thanks again for listening. If I'm not back next week, I'll be back, God willing, in 2 weeks. Take care of yourselves. Until then, Jay Shapiro signing off.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling from the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.